I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
So you were talking to us the other day, and by us, I mean the folks at work, about one of your pastimes, which isn't really very programming related, but somehow, because you're you were able to bend it to fit a group of technical people. So I figured we should take the opportunity to ask you on this podcast about that so that you can, you know, give more people a window into the world that you would describe. So do you want to talk about it?
This is definitely off-brand for us. But
right.
Hopefully
I don't know. There's
we're going to statistically lose 7/10 of our listener on this one.
Well, the expected return of our listener reduces, but... tell me about golf.
Golf, man.
And not code golf in this instance.
No, not code golf or frisbee golf or there's got to be other kinds of golf. No, I've been playing golf for a long time. I've been playing golf since I was 10, 11, 12, somewhere in that range. And lately, there's been a lot of changes to the game of golf. And it's been... able to be quantified a lot more than it could in the past. And this has sort of exposed some sort of like, you know, well-trodden, well-known, you know, sort of old wisdom as being incorrect or misleading. And as a result, the game has changed pretty dramatically. And in fact, I think you could say that in the last 20 years, golf has probably changed more than it has in the first 500 years. I mean, golf has been played since the 15th century. So, and to back this claim up, this is a pretty bold claim.
It's a bold claim. Very bold.
And to back this claim up, I would maybe point to one of the most recent major tournaments in golf, the PGA Championship. The course had to be laid out in a way such that one of the tees was on the opposite side of a green of another hole. Like the golfers had to wait for the players on the green to clear before they could tee off.
Knocking a ball over their heads,
because they're hitting
basically.
It over the green, over their heads. And the reason for this is because the length of the course as it was originally laid out, which wasn't that long ago, was just too short. Too short for the modern game. And so they had to lengthen it, and they didn't really have any space to lengthen it into. So they're like, well, we're just going to put it on the other side of the green. And yes, that kind of sucks because it means that people are going to have to wait. But this is my
like
evidence for
crazy
for,
golf.
Yeah. It's like
through the windmill.
Golf
and out the
golf
other side.
Courses over the hill and under the thing, and you got to hit it through this pipe. And sort of the changes that have occurred in golf, and they're technological changes, but I think there are also some more sort of statistical changes, or sort of the Moneyball effect that
I was going to say. It sounds very much like Mike Moneyball, but you're saying this is over and above like what I might imagine is like better nutrition, understanding of the physics of it, like in terms of musculature and stuff like that. Something more strategic. What I mean.
I think it's two things. I think there's two things, and they both have their own sort of nerdy aspects to it. But you know, today we're probably just going to focus on one. One is just the technology,
right?
Like, golf balls that fly farther, drivers that hit the ball farther. You know, distance has been sort of a main factor, but also you know, technology around like, you know, spin and control and wedges and all these other things. In the last 20 years, the last 25 years have changed really significantly, much more than I think that they have.
As a layperson, like a golf stick is a golf stick, right? It's just a long tube of metal with a thing on the end of it you hit the ball with. But you're saying there's a lot more sophistication than that.
Yeah. Mostly with golf balls, but also with clubs, specifically drivers.
Okay.
You know, like, you know, 50 years ago, driver with a metal head on it was a revolutionary thing, right? Like they used to be made out of wood.
They were woods. That's what I still think of them as wood, right? Because like my dad's old set would be made of wood. But yeah, I do remember
And then you know they sort of invented like, okay, what if we made them out of steel? And now they're made out of carbon fiber composite, right?
Wow.
TaylorMade actually just came out with a new driver that is entirely carbon fiber composite. There's no titanium in it, which is what. So these kinds of developments have especially for the pros, but also for amateur players, really more for pros, changed the game pretty significantly. Right. And then the other thing, aside from sort of the technology, the equipment technology that changed, is the stuff that I talked about yesterday, which is being able to quantify things about the game, about strategy, about swing, golf swings, and the effect that they have on the ball in ways that people were just kind of like assuming based on their observations.
Right.
Right.
Right. I remember the sort of like cooking, to completely take this off track, but mm-hmm. I remember like a friend of mine, you know, this is probably 10 years ago, saying like, you know, so many things that we know in quotes about cooking don't bear out if you actually try experimenting with it and try measuring it and try using like a heat lamp and whatever. I mean, you know about this stuff as well.
Yes,
but like,
yes.
You know, because these things get passed down and without any way to check, you go right. with the sort of essentially superstition over these things. And now you're saying we have ways of measuring and saying, are we actually doing what we think we're doing?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So we have some of the more recent developments, and I think, again, this is sort of like over the last 20 years or so, you've got launch monitors. You've got devices that you can put down when you hit a golf club, and using either high-speed cameras or radar or both, it can measure very precisely what direction the ball flies,
you put
how
down
far
a little
it goes.
Thing on the yep. like near where your ball is, and you mm-hmm. like click a button or whatever, and then you sort of take your shot, and then you get some yeah. kind of telemetry about what the heck happened.
Exactly. You don't even need to click a button; it just detects that there was a golf
I guess,
shot,
and yeah.
it'll record that. And there's different mechanisms that they use to do this, but you can get very precise information about what the face angle of the club was when it hit the ball. Was it pointing 3 degrees to the right, or was it pointing 3 degrees to the left? Was it straight? What the spin of the ball was as it came off the club, how fast it was moving, the angle that it was moving at, the angle that the club was moving down into the ball when it hit it,
or was it
you know, maybe going up at a different angle, you know, how far behind or in front of the ball did it hit? And so
that's a lot of information.
Yeah, it's a ton. It's a ton of information.
And just nerding out for a second there, like, this is kind of pretty cool stuff if you're doing very high speed. Because, I mean, how many... Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't a regular regular cameras you might have on your phone. Because, like, I can't imagine in the small area that the club head and the ball are in that it spends more than a thousandth of a second in that
right.
kind of area. Something of that
yes.
order. And that's
yes.
like, not very much time to record all that telemetry and to be able to look at it. How amazing.
Yeah.
And then to process it. And you say you're doing spin. It's doing spin recognition. So mm-hmm. presumably the dimples on the ball are enough for it to do, like,
and
motion
the markings,
compensation.
Yeah, like the logo, basically, yes.
Oh, my
yes.
God. So, like, there's... I mean, right, just to get a bit of tech into this, actual tech into this,
right.
like, there's a lot of
yeah.
cool things going on in there. That's really, really clever.
Yeah.
But anyway, the result is you get a ton of information about your shot that allows you to make determinations about whether
right,
what
right.
actually made the difference.
And these devices now have come down in price. The technology's gotten good enough. They're very accurate. And they're not that expensive. You know, a really good launch monitor is kind of expensive, costs about $20,000.
Right, that's a lot of money.
that's the sort of the high end.
Okay.
But you can get ones for the price of a laptop computer. You can
okay.
get one for, you know, for like $500 to $2,000, $3,000.
And if
that
you're,
are
if you're
very
taking it very
good.
Seriously, you know, as a hobby,
yeah.
that's not an totally unreasonable amount of money to
right,
spend.
Right,
right.
And the sort of democratization of this technology where it's, you know, and especially a lot of these things really took off with COVID because people were, you know, at home. Not a lot to do. Wound up with a little bit of extra spending cash. It was sort of like, well, I can't go out anymore. I can't actually go out and play golf, although they did eventually open that up. What do? Well, I'll go buy one of these launch monitors. And so the availability of these things and the sort of ubiquity of them has allowed people to talk about golf in a quantifiable way where they couldn't before. Right? You have instructors now that are, you know, used to say things like, oh, what you need to do is get your left arm a little bit more flat. Right? Like that's the way to improve your scores. And now you have instructors that say, no, what you need is to decrease your angle of attack with the club face from 7.2 degrees down to 4.2 degrees down because you're hitting down too much on the ball and you need to get it down from 7 to 4. And you can have somebody that just sits there and like you don't even need to tell them what to do with their arms or their body or their whatever. You just say, try to hit it less down. And they're like, oh, I went from 7 to 6.8. Good, you're improving. Do more of that. Well, I'm down
oh,
to
gosh.
5.2. Oh,
so
great.
I was
gonna
say, like,
keep
with,
going to
say, with all this technology, it sort of seems like it takes out the humanity of it somehow. But like, not at all, because the skill level is still absolutely required to have that
absolutely,
like dexterity
yes.
and fine motor control at that velocity right. and strength that you're presumably putting into it as well. So,
right,
it lets you have a very quantum. Yeah, I, you know, I'm having a sort of flashback to my poor dad trying to teach me to play golf and standing behind me and telling me all the things that I'm doing wrong. And I'm sure yes. he's right about almost all of them. But like, I don't know how. I know I was definitely doing something wrong because I wasn't very good.
right. And I think this has had a really positive effect on the game for lots of reasons. One is it creates a feedback cycle. You know, we talk about yeah. feedback on this podcast quite often.
Yep.
And it creates a feedback cycle that is much more quantifiable, obviously, but I think also much less prone to superstition.
Yeah.
Right? Like oh, you got to keep your head down, or you got to keep your left arm straight, you know, all these kinds of things. Like, okay, well, what effect does that have on the ball?
What does it really and then it's, do?
Yeah,
if
what does
I, yeah,
that actually
if I
do?
I lift my head up at the
and,
end of the shot.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of like, well, once you master it, it'll make your shots better. It's like, well, that's a long time away, and that seems like a really long investment to make. Like, can I do something that will just make it better right now?
Mm-hmm.
And with these sort of like, you know, the sort of impact dynamics and like understanding how ball flight works, which is another thing, sidebar, golfers were wrong about that for 500 years.
What?
Like the way that ball flight actually works, there's if you Google golf new ball flight laws,
yes,
you will figure out that only in the last 20 years have people actually figured out how golf balls really fly off a club. And that is in large part because of this technology and these launch
they're markers. Able to look at it and go, oh yeah, that's not true at all.
Yes. So now we've come into this world where you can say, like, okay, I'm not going to give you all this advice that might maybe one day be useful. I can look at the physics of the ball. I can measure what you're actually doing on this launch monitor. And I can tell you, yeah, the path of your club is in to out by 5 degrees, and that's too much. That's what causes your hook. So you need to narrow that down to 2 degrees, and you will immediately see the flight of your ball change. Now, whether you can repeat that on the golf course or whether you can do other things is practice, and you have to still all do those things.
As a layperson, like, yeah. I could see that really gamifying it for myself to be able to, like, mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing wrong, and I can sort of fathom out what I might need to change. But when it's just randomly going off to the left and my dad saying, oh, no, you need to open the club face or whatever. And I'm like, I think I'm doing that and it's getting worse. I don't know if, am I just doing it wrong? Or is there some supposition that we both have wrong? Is that not how it really works? Interesting.
Right.
So that obviously makes a lot of sense, right? If you can understand the physics of the situation and what you need to change the direction of the ball as it comes off the club head, and also the way it's spinning and interacting with the air and all that kind of stuff. But what else can you do with numbers?
So the other thing that you can do, and this is another sort of a more recent development, I think. And the pithy phrase for this is a golf club is a shotgun, not a rifle. And what that means is that when you hit a golf ball, having an expectation that it is going to fly, you know, 150 yards and land and roll out 5 yards or something like that is just a flawed way to think about golf. What you should be thinking about is, this is my dispersion area.
I see.
I'm going to hit a ball and it's going to be somewhere in this area. And the essence of strategy really is just mapping that dispersion area for all your different shots to the hole that's in front of you and trying to pick the one that has the best results.
The most favorable outcomes and the least unfavorable. So like a Monte Carlo simulation of like, given that you're going to be landing in this region with this sort of probability density, what's the right place to aim for to get the best chance? Because like you say, I mean, like, you know, my limit of playing golf is on the Wii, so you know where it's going to land because there's a dirty great big line showing you where it's going to land, and it bounces beautifully every time. There's never any surprises, but I have noticed that in real life that doesn't tend to happen, so
it doesn't really work that
so
way.
You're saying there's a strategy here over and above just get it to this point. That's the nearest point you can get to without getting into the water, and then go from the water to the over the water to the hole or whatever it is.
And then sort of quantifying like what is the sort of expected value in that area is another place where both the sort of launch monitor technology and other technology, so there's other cool things that they have, and this is only possible because of GPS, which is only possible because of NASA, which is only possible because of, and you go all the way back
all
in time
back
and you see how all these wonderful things tie together.
Einstein's theory of relativity, general theory of relativity, and
Exactly. So thanks, Einstein, for the ability us to play golf in this way, where you have devices that you can attach to your golf clubs that will track all of your shots on the course.
Neat.
And that will give you some interesting information. It'll help you calculate these dispersion areas that we're talking about.
Oh, right. Empirically so. Like, you know, yes, I was here with a 7-iron, and it doesn't matter what I did, I landed in this region, and I can play the same hole 20 times and go, where did I land from the tee every time or whatever.
Exactly. Neat. Which you can also do in the launch monitor, and you can compare those two results. Like, you can hit, you know, 10 7-irons on a launch monitor and see what your dispersion area is, and then you can go down a golf course, and you can play, and you can take that data and you know, correlate it together and be like, am I seeing on the course what I'm seeing on my launch monitor? No, why not?
Why not?
Well, maybe the wind, or maybe I'm, you know, following a slightly different, you know, routine when I'm on the golf course, you know, on a launch monitor, I'm just hitting the same balls over and over again, and I need to mix it up or whatever it might be. You can correlate those things. And then taking all of this information, and especially the shot location information, one of the more interesting things that the professional PGA Tour did is in 2001, they built this system that uses laser rangefinding to measure to just a few inches where every golf professional on every tournament hits their ball. So there's this really rich data set that is available that you can get that shows for all of these different shots. And using that information, there was a guy named Mark Brody that came up with this this technique called strokes gained, where there used to be, you know, lots of different ways to measure sort of the quality of a golf shot, right? People would say, did you hit the green in regulation? Or did you hit the fairway? Did you hit the, you know, all these different things? Mm-hmm. And these stats, like, they weren't really good. They didn't really tell you anything. And so what he wanted to do is to be able to compare from one shot to the next, from one player to the next, from one course to the next, how good was this shot? How can I quantify that?
Right.
Right?
How do I rate a particular shot?
Yes. And he wanted to measure, the unit of measure that he wanted to use was strokes. So he could make claims like, that strategy that you chose was 2/10 of a stroke worse than this other strategy that you could have chosen.
Fractional strokes here as well. Like, to be able to do a quantifiable analysis between things where, you know,
Right. So he wanted to be able to do that. So his method for doing this was basically, he came up with a system where he measured the average number of strokes that it took professionals and amateurs, actually, he did this for amateurs too, but it was easier with professionals because the data was there, to say how many strokes on average does it take to hole out from a particular location on the course. So if you're, you know, 420 yards away on the tee, on average, that's like 4.1 strokes for a professional golfer
Par four or whatever, and that's what the course is.
Well, it doesn't even matter what the
par four
is. I
guess it doesn't matter. No. Yeah. This is like an empirical determination.
Yeah. It could be a par five. It could be a par four. It doesn't matter. We're measuring how many strokes does it take on average from golfers to hole out from this location.
From this particular location. So there's a kind of a map over, I'm sort of imagining a map of the golf course where I can like see the contours of, from here we'd expect to be four strokes, from here we'd expect to be three, two, and then once you get around the hole, one or whatever. And that's kind of your expected, if you could play like a professional.
Yes, an average professional from this location, the expected number of strokes would be 3.2, right? Or 1.6.
Yep.
And so the way that he measures, the way that the system he came up with to do this was, okay, we're going to take the average from your starting location.
Yep.
We're going to subtract one because you're hitting a stroke.
Right,
so
you're
if
taking
you hit a stroke,
that shot.
You would expect to get one better.
Yep.
Right? And then we're gonna subtract the expected number of strokes at the ending location. So if you start out at a starting location and your average is 4.1, and you hit a shot, so we're gonna subtract now and go down to 3.1.
Because like given this system being perfect, then every time you hit a stroke, you should be one stroke nearer to the hole.
One stroke nearer to the hole, right? Exactly. And then if your ending location turned out to not be very good, like you didn't hit a very good shot, and your ending location wasn't 3.1, it was actually like 3.3, then you've actually lost 2/10 of a stroke on that.
I see. Right?
Whereas if you hit a better shot and your ending location was 2.8, then, you know, 3.1 minus 2.8, you actually gained 3/10 of a stroke. So you did better. Right.
That's
and now he
really
had this system that he could use to quantify and say, like, if you hit this shot, you gained 2/10 of a stroke. If you hit this shot, you lost 4/10 of a stroke. Clearly, this is better.
Well, so that's so what you can empirically determine for any one position, like where you are, right. what you should get, and then hit the ball, where did you end up? And then you can just say, like, I can say that it was a gained 0.2 of a stroke there.
Yes, yes. And this system takes into account the lie that you have. It takes into account how far you are from the hole. It takes into account whether or not you have a clear line to the flag. So if you have to, like, chip out, you know, something like that.
Oh, I see. If you're, like, behind a tree or
Yeah, yeah. If you're stuck behind a tree.
Again, all of my experience comes from Wii Sports, really. So, I mean, like, we're not really talking.
Yeah, yeah. So you can imagine taking this information.
Okay.
And then combining it with the shot dispersion patterns.
Oh.
And now what you're basically doing is just trying to find an area with the lowest stroke or with the most strokes gained.
Oh, gosh. So you have a huge data set of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got this map of where what the scoring, like expected score from any location is.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
you can apply the two and kind of work out. See if there are patterns, presumably, in this data.
See if there are patterns. And so to maybe make a video game out of this.
Yes.
Imagine you've got this little slider, and you can just go through all your clubs. And as you change from, you know, 7-iron, 8-iron, 9-iron, you know, wedge, whatever. And as you do that, you can see your dispersion pattern for that club
right. Changing
and being overlaid on the hole,
yep.
right? Now imagine, furthermore, that the area inside your dispersion pattern, you take the strokes gained from that area, and you take the average of it, and you just show it on the screen, right?
Ah.
And as you sort of like let's say that you're farther away from the hole, you're like 200 yards away from the hole, right? And you're like, okay, well I could hit like my 3-wood that goes, you know, about 200 yards, but there's a creek that runs in front of the green. So as you go, as you scroll through and you go 7-iron, 8, you know, 6-iron, 5-iron, you know, 5-wood, 3-wood, that stroke gain is going
danger zone
up and
creek.
Up and up, right? And then all of a sudden you start intersecting with the creek, and then uh-huh. it starts going down again, right? It's like, oh, because you might hit in the creek, and that'll be a one-stroke penalty,
got it.
Right? And so, like, and then as you move your aim left to right, you know, maybe you can hit it that far but take the creek out of play, right? And that's, like, the quantification of golf strategy,
got it.
Right?
It's you like, can it's run like, that Monte Carlo simulation and say, like,
right.
what is my expected value for this club given my abilities and my dispersion
right.
and the actual lie that I'm currently in and
yes.
the actual
yes.
place that I'm going to end up in
right.
or, like,
right.
the likely areas, and I can weight them however that's... All right, so now now you've definitely turned it into a video game where now, and well, in fact, what you've turned it into is what our day job is,
yeah, that's
which
right.
is sort of quantitative, like trying to find the minimum or the maximum of some kind of very, very complicated feature set, which
right.
is exactly what this is, right? You
know? Right, right, right.
Wow.
Yeah, and especially like more skilled golfers, it's not like they just have like their 7-iron shot, right? They have 5 or 6 different shots they can hit with a 7-iron,
yeah.
and each one of them has their own dispersion pattern. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, potentially hundreds of different patterns that you could potentially map onto a hole. And so, you know, as a player or as a caddy, especially on tour, like you're standing there, like, I don't think that these guys are like, you know, mapping these things out quite on the course quite yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if that sort of thing starts to maybe happen a little bit.
It's pretty high-stake stuff. So, I mean,
the drive
to want to do this kind of stuff. So
exactly.
are there any, like, general things that come out of analyzing this data? You mentioned right at the beginning that, like, there are some old folk wisdom things that have been shown to be wrong. So is there something in this is there a conclusion we can draw from, like, this kind of data that would help even, like, someone as inept as myself?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you may remember some of these things from your youth being taught golf. There's things about the swing that turn out not to be true, and there's things about strategy that turn out not to be true.
Oh, okay.
One of the things about the swing that turns out not to be true is I was taught as a young lad, because this is golf, that the way that you shape a golf shot, so the way that you control whether your ball is going to, you know, curve to the right or curve to the left.
Right.
Right, because that's sometimes important in golf. You got to curve it around a tree or some
around
other
around a
obstacle,
dog leg
right?
or something. Yeah,
yeah, something
again,
like that.
Again, Wii Sports is where I've seen this happen,
or not
on purpose at the driving range when I'm doing it. Like, why?
Right.
Why is it
right.
going? Why is
why
it going back
that? Why did it do that? Yeah, exactly. So the old school wisdom on how to mm-hmm. do this, the thing that was taught by teachers and by professionals, you know, forever, was that you pointed the face of the club at the place where you wanted the ball to wind up.
Okay, yes.
And then you swung the club along a path that represented the way that you wanted the ball to start. So if you wanted the ball to curve toward a target, you would point the club at the target. And then if you wanted it to curve from the left to the right, you would swing the club to the left.
Effectively opening and closing the club face to point to where you want to go, but then your swing direction is where is the launch direction, effectively.
Yes.
Got it. I think that makes sense. Yep.
Yes, yes. Turns out that's completely wrong.
Okay.
You listen
to this, Dad.
It's basically the opposite of that, in a way. The initial launch, you can see this on a high-speed camera. You can you can verify it with all these new devices that we have available to us. The initial path of the ball, 85% of that initial path is determined by the face angle. So the starting line is the face angle.
It's actually the face angle. So like you hit it with... Yeah, okay. Even though the club is kind of... it's hard to describe with that because I'm gesturing wildly at you, but...
Right,
but
right.
That's
but
fascinating.
Where the club face is pointing at impact, 85% of that initial direction is determined by that angle.
Got it.
Right? Where it curves is a function of the relationship between that angle and the path.
Right.
And so the general rule is if you want the ball to curve to a target, neither the face nor the club path should be pointing at that target. What you want to try to do is roughly, and unfortunately it's not exactly this, but roughly you want the club face to be pointing in between the target line and the path of the club.
Okay.
So as a person who's trying to master this for the first time, I have these memories as a kid of like trying to, set myself up as like, okay, I'm going to point the club face at the target and I'm going to swing along this path and I'm going to hit it. And what I would see is that the ball would start at the target and then curve
away
more
from
off
it.
To the side.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, well, I guess maybe I had it wrong. What did I do wrong here? And it's like, no, that's exactly, you were doing exactly what you thought you were doing. It just doesn't work that way, right?
How has that been so persistent for so long?
It's like the cooking thing. Yeah. It's like, oh, you got to sear the steak to seal in the juices,
right? I was thinking exactly of searing when I was bringing this up. It's like, that's not a thing. It doesn't...
It's like, no, that doesn't work like that at all, right? It's just one of those things that it's like, oh, well, if you're an expert, this is what you say. And then that gets passed down and passed down and passed down. And then finally somebody was like, guys, I got this video here. It's 20,000 frames a second. And you can kind of see it doesn't work like that. So I don't know what you were taught, but it doesn't go.
Right? If it works at all.
Yeah. So that is one thing. Another thing, and this is more on the strategy side, but it used to, people had this pithy saying, drive for show, putt for dough. And what they meant by that was that putting was really important and driving was sort of seemed cool. And it's like, oh yeah, I hit the ball 300 yards, but it's really not all that.
That's
important.
Absolutely what I, as an extremely terrible golfer, like a friend of mine said, I learned quote bad golf where, if you're bad at golf, you can get by doing these things. Just learn to, putt reasonably well. Everything else, I basically play hockey with a 7-iron down the fairway till I get into the hole, and then is putting it. All right, now I'm good. But I could probably putt with a 7-iron too. That's the only club that I need.
They just need a 7-iron.
Just a 7-iron. Yeah. It's fine, right? As you say, you can play many shots with a 7-iron.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to play golf.
Yeah. But that's not true. Why? How is that not true? And
it is,
how do you know it's
very
not true?
Not true. How do I know it's not true? Is the real question we should be asking. So this gets back to Mark Brody and his strokes gained approach. He wanted to try to figure out like what makes good golfers good at every level, right?
Okay.
At the PGA Tour level, if you take the top 40 golfers, the best 40 golfers in the world, what makes them better than the rest of them that are on tour? Because the rest of them on tour are so amazingly good.
Right.
But they're not as good as these people.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he looked at, he basically analyzed, he said, okay, well, they perform better. I can use strokes gained to quantify how much better they perform. And I can break that down by category, right? So how much does putting actually contribute to that top 40 players' additional ability? It's actually only 15%.
What? So
that is so drive for show, putt for dough doesn't really hold up.
So sorry, 15% is go through that again for me because I'm being slow.
So if you let's take the top 40 golfers in the world and let's compare them to the other professional golfers in the world.
Okay.
They gain more strokes. in the strokes gained methodology.
Yeah, okay. If we say that,
strokes gained, right? So you like the top 40 golfers, let's just say, I'm making these numbers up, but let's say that they gain like, you know, 2.5 strokes on average versus all the other ones, right? Where does that 2.5 strokes come
from? I see. And then you can say, where did
15% of it comes from putting.
Okay. So of the overall improvement, only 15 can be attributed to putting.
Exactly.
I get that. Exactly. Now. Okay.
And driving
contributes
to 28%, so almost twice as much.
Okay.
So it turns out driving is twice as important as putting.
Which, again, is like so not the received wisdom. Because, and especially, you know, like there's a non-linearity between accuracy and whacking it as hard as you possibly can. So, you know, maybe, yeah. But so that might work for professionals, but is that true generally?
Yeah. So he did the same analysis. So he didn't have the shot link data, but he actually built an app to allow people to track their own shots.
Oh,
and there are other people, you know, I was talking before about those devices now that you can get that will track your shots. And those devices have reproduced his results and show the same thing, which is that at every skill level, the thing that differentiates the higher skilled from the lesser skilled players is roughly this. So if we look at on the PGA Tour, so we talked about, you know, putting is 15%, driving is 28%. Driving isn't even the most important thing. So the whole drive for show, putt for dough, it's like, well, guys, you left out the most important thing, which is actually approach play.
Approach.
So hitting into greens, right? So hitting from the fairway, hitting from the rough into greens.
So not on the tee and not,
yeah,
on,
not
the
on
the green,
tee,
but like the
green,
middle bit.
The middle bit,
right?
accounts for 40%.
Oh my gosh.
Of the difference. Right? So that is the dominating factor. And that's true at the professional level. It's also true at the amateur level. So for example, the difference between a golfer who usually shoots around 90 and a golfer that usually shoots around 80, 67% of their strokes gain, of their advantage, is from driving and approach play. And only 33% is from putting and like chipping and sand shots.
Same kind of, so again, that sort of putting and the sort of special shots, like is only a third of it.
Out
two
of
thirds
sand
is just
decent
play in the middle and the beginning. That's amazing that you can get that amount of information. And I mean, I am genuinely surprised that it holds up in the amateur set. Because again, based on personal experience, I can reliably chip the ball forward 50 yards with a 7-iron, right? If I don't try too hard and it goes roughly where I want it to go. But as soon as I try too hard, then that's when it's off into the undergrowth and I'm searching around for it. So obviously, a base level of skill will help you some amount, but...
Yeah. Well, one explanation for this, which makes a lot of sense to me, at least as a golfer, is that I can hit an 8-foot putt. You can hit an 8-foot putt. And you can have some expectation of making that 8-foot putt, right?
Yeah. Okay.
A professional can hit an 8-foot putt. And they're going to make it more often than we do, but they can do that. That's a shot that they can hit. There's no way in the world that I'm hitting a 7-iron 210 yards. Mm-hmm. I'm physically incapable of doing that.
Right.
I can hit a ball 210 yards, but it's not going to have that like descent angle into the green
that it's going to make it,
and the spin rate that'll make it hold and stick on the green.
And not just run off forever afterwards, right?
Yes. I have to basically hit a perfect shot to hit a shot onto a green from 210 yards. And I am just not physically capable of hitting this high arcing spinning shot onto a green from 210 yards that stays there. And so that's one explanation, and I think it's the one that Brody likes and a few other people have said, as to why this phenomena happens, because that advantage that professionals have, that 40% advantage, is being able to hit approach shots, and specifically longer approach shots into greens. And that is just shots that amateurs just can't do. Like, you can hit a chip from 50 yards, I can hit a chip from 50 yards, Tiger Woods can hit a chip from 50 yards. But only Tiger can hit his 7-iron 200 yards.
And then land and have it stop.
And
roughly.
Then land and have it stop.
And then that,
right?
That again, down to the splash zone, the danger,
exactly.
What do you call it? Like
the dispersion area.
Dispersion area,
right?
It's much better than the splash zone of where the shot's going to land. That's fascinating.
Right. And also with driving, you know, Tiger can hit that 320-yard, or at least he could in his prime, hit that 320-yard, and professionals today can hit balls in 400 yards. I can't physically do that.
That's,
you can give me 1,000 tries and I just wouldn't be able
to do
that.
It's a very long way.
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. So all this stuff comes around to sort of show us that, you know, you need data to be able to.
Need data.
I mean, you can convince yourself anything without data.
Right.
Sometimes you can convince yourself anything when you do have data. You know, like with see for example, yes. benchmarking and micro benchmarks and other things where right. you can kind of convince right. yourself, yeah, look, it's much faster this way, only because the branch predictor has got everything right every time, or whatever, yes. whatever your folly is there. But in order to actually have some genuine understanding of what's going on and to be able to dispel myths and mm-hmm. and superstitions,
yes.
You do need the data, and now you can get it. And there, and so is this open data? Some of the stuff open data, or is it all closed?
So, you know, the one of the complaints that I have about all this is that the ecosystem around this, some of this data, is very closed. Like if you go and you buy these devices mm-hmm. and you record all your shots, like, you know, I put that in there. That's my data.
Yeah.
But the only way that you can really get to it is like through their websites or through their apps, right? And if the app disappears or the company goes out of business or whatever,
your
data is gone. And it's like, and if I want to load this into an Excel spreadsheet or like a
because
Google Doc
of course
or
you
like,
do.
You know, Python program, of course,
of
which
course.
I have done.
Oh, yes.
And analyze it myself, I can't do that. There's one company that I don't want to necessarily endorse anyone on the podcast, but there are companies out there that have more open data access. They'll let you get your data
right.
as a CSV file, which is exactly how I
exactly
want it,
what,
right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I just want a simple, open, portable format
and
for
then
my
you
data,
can go
please.
And do your own analysis.
And then I can go do my own thing.
Yeah.
But most of them don't do that. They have these sort of closed ecosystems. Now, it's good for them. Like one of the companies that is very popular and unfortunately has a closed ecosystem is called Arcos. And they have $500 million golf shots in their database,
golly.
Right? Of amateur golfers that have hit real golf shots on real courses measured with GPS. And I follow the head of data analytics at Arcos on Twitter because he's got some amazing insights into golf.
Yep.
But I want to do that analysis myself.
You
I want to be able
to
reproduce
too.
His results right
yeah.
now. I understand why the company isn't exactly forthcoming in sharing
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I mean, especially aggregated data. I mean, if just the privacy aspects alone, right, as a part of it. Because obviously you want to have some idea about what quality level various golfers are and
yes.
whatever, so you can
yes.
partition the data.
But I can't even get my own data.
Data.
Out of
that
there,
seems unforgivable
right?
to me.
It is. Now, the launch monitor companies actually, I think, have been pretty good about this, right? Like they have more open formats and you can generally get access to your data. But all these companies that build like the club tracking, there's only one that I know of that lets you get your data off, and I think that's a damn
well,
shame.
Well, a good friend of mine, who I'm talking to right now, has told me before now that if you have a website, then you have an API. So is there any way that you could exfiltrate your own data?
I have thought about that.
Of course you have.
I was a little bit incensed by the idea of, okay, let me understand how this works. So I pay you $200 for these devices, and then I pay you $30 a year for a subscription fee, and then I have to write the JavaScript bookmarklet that goes and extracts the data off your website, and it isn't even all the data that I would want. Like I want lat longs. I want all of the data that I gave you. I just want you to give back to me.
Right.
Right. And some of that even doesn't show up on their website. So I've been a little reluctant to sort of follow that path, but I do have a system, and the system that I have does allow you to export your data. And I actually just got it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sort of like, you know,
you're still playing with it
in the candy store.
That's great.
Cause I have like one round of golf in there, and I'm like picking it apart and going, like, oh, I wonder if I could calculate this, or calculate that. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, all of this stuff is kind of amazing. And the fact that, like, you know, it's really just like advances in technology that have made all of this possible. And I really do, I mean, it is a bold claim, but I really do think that golf has changed more in the last 25 years than it did in the first 500. You know, yeah, okay, the golf ball changed. They used to play with what's called a feathery, which is basically a piece of leather with feathers stuffed into it, and that's your golf ball. And then they had the gutta percha ball, which was like a rubberized ball. And then, you know, the bolata ball, which is the ball that, was like a synthetic ball that golfers played with, you know, in like the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And then it started to change. And I feel like that was the beginning of both the technological and sort of the quantification change in golf that has created a situation where it's like obsoleting golf courses, right? Golf courses that were made 100 years ago
now are not fit for
purpose. Now are like what do we do? We got to move the T's back, but there's nowhere to go.
I see.
Right?
Gosh.
So I feel like that's a pretty significant change.
Well, I mean, I'd never thought that we would sit here on a programming podcast doing essentially golf for hackers, as we have done.
Right.
But,
right,
I mean, it's really fascinating, and I might even be tempted to pick up a golf stick myself.
Well, if you ever want to play, let me know.
Okay, I will do.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Twitter at @2CP, that's at @TWOSCP. Theme music by Inverse Phase, inversephase.com.